Hello, and welcome to today's VJ Hemonc podcast. We are a global, open access video journal bringing you the latest in hematology and hematological oncology. In this podcast series, we will be sharing content from the 2024 Intercepting Blood Cancers Workshop. In today's episode, you will hear from experts who discuss early interception, advances in risk stratification, and novel agents being explored for smoldering myeloma. First, Shaji Kumar, Bruno Paiva, and Elena Zamagni give an overview of novel technologies being explored to risk stratify individuals with smoldering myeloma and MGUS, highlighting the value of circulating tumor cells and imaging techniques.
Hi, I'm Shaji Kumar. I'm attending the IBC 2024 meeting here in Lisbon. I would like to introduce my colleagues who are going to be part of the discussion today. This Dr. Bruno Paiva and Dr. Elena Zamagni. And we will be talking about an exciting area today, which is the whole concept of early interception in multiple myeloma and related disorders. So we have known for a long time that myeloma is always preceded by monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance and also smoldering multiple myeloma. And this offers an opportunity for interception early on in the course of the disease. But the challenge always has been identifying who are the individuals who are going to progress. And a lot of progress has been made, and we have been discussing about the different approaches we can take to identify these patients. And this is an area that is constantly improving, and there's certainly a lot of new technologies that are coming along. And you talked about the circulating tumor cells and how we can use that. How do you propose that this would be, or how we use that in the future?
Thank you, Shaji, for bringing that topic. I must say that part of our inspiration and motivation to study in greater detail tumor cells in the peripheral blood, so-called circulating tumor cells, and more generally CTCs, it was in fact by some of your studies. In particular, one that was published, I believe, in 2021, where you analyzed how stable or unstable patients, the risk of patients with smoldering myeloma was over time. And you are looking mainly to the M protein, as well as the free light chains in the serum, the two markers that are part of the International Myeloma Working Group risk model for smoldering myeloma. And of course, you are not looking longitudinally over time to the amount of tumor burden in the marrow, because of course, patients are not undergoing serial bone marrow assessments. Now, looking at that data and knowing the importance of identifying stable versus evolving patterns in biomarkers such as hemoglobin, M protein, eventually the beta 2 microglobulin, also lesions detected by imaging, we felt that there was probably an unmet need to find a certain amount of tumor burden, a cutoff in the peripheral blood, so that you could add that information onto your well-known prognostic factors. That was the motivation.
That's great. I mean, clearly, I mean, the 20 to 20 certainly is something that everyone can use. It's in the clinic, it's protein, it's bone marrow plasma cell percentage test that we do every day. But the problem with the 20 to 20 system is it doesn't allow us to identify everybody who is going to progress, and doesn't, there are still patients who are considered as high risk by 20 to 20, but still progress much early on, and high risk patients don't progress. So the ability to discriminate, I mean, especially if you're thinking of treating them early, we want to really decrease the number of people to almost none that who might be unnecessarily treated. And so I think, you know, certainly the circulating tumor cell is one thing. And you talked about the imaging. I mean, that's one area that is obviously needs, I mean, certainly a lot of information, but I think we need to get a lot more information.
Yeah, sure. What imaging, new imaging did was to redefine the definition of smoldering myeloma. So this is done and we are all relying on this. So it's, well, a very good job that was concluded. What we can do now is decide which patient should be followed up by imaging, which smoldering myeloma patient, and maybe which patient are at higher risk to develop focal lesion or bone disease. So I think that the fields are integrating, so for sure all the patients without lesion, and that's of course quite obvious maybe, but a patient with a dynamic pattern of smoldering myeloma should be followed up to my opinion, because they are at higher risk, as well as patient with maybe high circulating tumor cells. So somehow those different parts are integrating. So I agree with Bruno, we cannot propose continuous imaging for everyone, as well as we cannot propose bone marrow aspiration for everyone continuously. So we may have an interval between based on circulating biomarkers, and then to go for imaging in definite time points. So things are melting together and are creating a more, let's say, complete risk stratification model. And we also spoke about dynamic, of course, that's very important to be added.
And may I ask a question to the experts? Because it may well be that for patients with stable biomarkers in the first months, years of assessment, that is probably identifying a smoldering myeloma with a different biology. Probably those patients that reach into almost a flat line of progression after 5, 10, 15 years, as we have seen in the curves from Dr. Kyle in the New England papers. And in such a way, in those cases, you could eventually fade away in time, those assessments.
Yeah. And that is that's a very good point, because again, when you look at this, and that is reflected in our clinical practice too, you know, we generally recommend that patients with smoldering myeloma get evaluated every 3 months. But if somebody is 5 years out or 10 years out from the diagnosis of smoldering, the risk is same as a monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance. So those patients at that point, we tend to watch, maybe see them every year or every other year. And so definitely that will change over time, depending upon...
Yeah. Once again, it's dynamic, so of course you can upgrade, but you can also downgrade. So probably one day those patients will be called MGUS, bigger MGUS, something similar, because they don't have anything about myeloma, truly. They are something different. So the biology is still studying those patients, and one day probably we will downgrade those patients in the MGUS group.
Yeah, I think it just highlights again, you know, you're talking about a real spectrum, right? So at one end, we are going to try and keep identifying people whom we need to do something about it before something bad happens. And on the other end, we're just going to keep identifying people whom we don't need to do anything at all. Just tell them they are just the same as a general population. And so that we kind of continue to chip away at both ends of the spectrum, so to speak.
That would be ideal. You know that we have a project ongoing. It is called No More MGUS. It's primarily focused on MGUS, but the concept applies to smoldering myeloma at those late stages or late years of disease stability. And the acronym of the project is like that, No More MGUS, because we truly would like to develop the tools in the laboratory to help you identifying those monoclonal gammopathies of no clinical significance. So no longer an undetermined significance, clear separation between clinical and lack of clinical significance. This is challenging, no doubts, but the field has already contributed a lot towards this concept, to the identification of monoclonal gammopathies, of renal significance, of neurological significance, thrombosis more recently. So it is possible to really fine-tune diagnostics.
Absolutely. And no future significance, right?
Yeah, excellent. For sure. And in this regard, we spoke about also from a clinical perspective, the value of proteinuria. So all these tools, very simple, nothing to do maybe with high science, but are useful not to misdiagnosis, not to make underestimation, to intercept MGRS, to intercept early amyloidosis. So we also have to keep in mind this. At the same time, in this session, we spoke a lot about very, very sophisticated biology that in selected centers should go on to truly understand better, dig better into those patients who are behaving so differently.
And I think, you know, one of the points that was made too is we probably not getting the maximum information out of the easily available data, because we generally tend to look at it as big chunks, you know, it's there or it's not there. But just looking at the patterns and how they interact over time using more of the AI type, artificial intelligence type approaches might tell us a lot more. Because often in the clinic, if the hemoglobin goes down by 0.1 or 0.2 over time, it doesn't really register as much as they are still in the normal range.
Yeah.
But it could be a, you know, five different variables all moving in the wrong direction, mm-hmm. still within the normal range, but could tell you that somebody is actually going to progress pretty soon.
That is a clear application for the near future, I would suspect, of AI and those kind of related tools.
Yeah, definitely. Probably here it's more easy because you don't have the variant of the treatment.
Yeah,
so in active myeloma, the problem with AI is that the treatment are becoming old and you're looking at something old. But here, without treatment, probably it's more field where it will be more easy.
Oh, we're certainly making a lot of progress. I'm sure we'll be able to get a better picture to the patients as we get all these tools closer to the clinic.
And I do think that another important aspect for that kind of information that's currently still being generated, how to analyze, integrate, probably relying on AI tools, is not only to improve our prediction of risk of transformation, but also our prediction of if the aim of early interception will be achieved or not, depending on what is the aim. And the aim might be prolonging for a long, long time the development of symptoms, or the aim might be curing, hopefully. But really, to use all the information that is being generated in the field of smoldering myeloma also to that purpose. A patient with these kind of characteristics may respond well or not to a certain type of early intervention.
Absolutely. So, a lot more to come.
Next, you will hear from Irene Gobriel, Omar Nadim, and Kui Yong, who discuss the possibility of early interception in smoldering myeloma, sharing insights into ongoing trials in the field, novel agents, and the importance of patient preference when making treatment decisions.
Hello, my name is Irene Gobriel. I'm from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and I'm excited here to be in the Interception of Blood Cancer meeting with Omar and Kui. Omar, do you mind introducing yourself?
Yes, I'm Omar Nadim. I'm also a physician at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Hey, I'm Kui Yong. I work at University College London in the UK.
So we just completed 2 days of discussions on early detection, risk stratification, and early interception across blood cancers, whether it's myeloma, lymphoma, and CLL, and myeloid malignancies, except especially clonal hematopoiesis. And I guess one question, of course, is should we be diagnosing patients early, and should we be intercepting, knowing that this is such a controversial area right now?
Yeah, no, I think it was a great meeting. We covered a lot of topics across all the different groups there. But yeah, no, I think there's so much to learn by, you know, identifying these patients and then following their natural sort of progression in terms of who's at risk and who isn't, and then what other comorbidities and problems are associated with having a clonal disorder like this. Specifically focusing on smoldering myeloma, we had a lot of interest based on early interception, you know, with some of the clinical trials that have already been done, but particularly with some of our newer immunotherapy trials that are showing a lot of promise. So, you know, it starts with identification of these patients, we learn their natural history, and then figure out which population benefits more, and that's what's happening now.
Now, you've presented beautiful data on the natural history of patients, and I was, you know, interested to see that even though we try to do our best with MRIs and PET CT scans, and many of us say, oh, we can find those patients, we can find you know, CRAB criteria before it happens, yet your data and the Mayo Clinic data as well as our data indicates that despite all efforts, patients still have fractures and lytic lesions, and we cannot diagnose them early enough. And really the question is, can we intercept those patients early?
Exactly, absolutely. And intercepting, diagnosing them and picking them up through screening is one thing, but actually preventing the organ damage is something else. So what we have to learn is how to follow them and what investigations to use, how to monitor these patients. And really, although it's such an exciting time, we have all this new technology, clearly we still don't understand enough about bone disease in smoldering myeloma and in myeloma. So I think bone disease is a big, big hurdle, and it really we need to try and prevent that. But in treating and intercepting smoldering myeloma, of course, we will prevent and avoid patients getting fractures, bone pain, bone morbidity. That the real goal is to identify the patients who will benefit most from treatment, and also which treatment is the best. I mean, your study on immunotherapy and bispecific antibodies is tremendous. It's a wonderful first step. Are all patients who need treatment suitable for that sort of treatment, or are there different treatment modalities and different strategies that we should be considering?
So maybe putting the end in mind, really thinking about the best therapies, and I think most of us will say, if I have something that is potentially curative, if I have something that's really giving me deep remissions with less toxicity and for a very short period of time, then many of us would be willing to take that risk. And not just us, it's the patients who are willing to take the risk. And I think that patient preference is so important compared to what physician preference is, because we're so into our dogma of don't treat until you have end organ damage. But the patient's requests from us as we see them in the clinic is, don't wait for me to have end organ damage and fractures. But tell us more about the immunotherapy, because maybe that's the answer to many of the questions and the potential benefit from early interception.
Yeah, it's remarkable to see how things have changed in less than 20 years, right? Where when first studies of lenalidomide were started in high-risk smoldering myeloma, with essentially the same goal, can you treat these patients early and prevent some of the organ damage that we see? And those were positive studies versus observation. And then the myeloma progress with therapeutics has moved on so tremendously over the next decade. And we had so many combination therapies. And then we tried to say, if getting a deeper and better response with these combination therapies can lead to cures or prevent progression even for longer in these patients. And those trials showed pretty good response rates. But, you're balancing the toxicity at that point and trying to figure out which one of those is best. And then came this immunotherapy era, all in the last 5 years or so, where we're seeing amazing results in relapse refractory myeloma. And then the natural question was, can we bring it early in the patients that are at high risk of progression, where they have a healthier immune system? And so far, we've demonstrated as part of this trial that this therapy is not only very, very efficacious with 100% response rate and 100% MRD negativity rate, but it's also pretty safe in terms of the toxicities that we're seeing. We were all worried about that with all of these approaches in smoldering myeloma, but I would say with a single agent, you're actually mitigating the disease quite extensively. But at the same time, the rates of CRS, are high-grade CRS we're not seeing at all. You do see some low-grade CRS, but nothing beyond what you would expect with this, agent. And then the risk of infections, which comes up with bispecific antibodies, and the way that's being mitigated is with lower frequency and lower doses over time, fixed duration therapy, and doing supportive care such as IVIG, et cetera, limit that. But this is just the beginning, right? This was the first trial that sort of studied this. Now we're already moving on to see what's the right duration, which is the right approach, et cetera. So I think this is going to change very, very quickly.
And just for the context, we're talking about teclistamab, but there are so many other bispecific antibodies. But one antibody, teclistamab, is showing us impressive responses with less toxicity compared to the relapse refractory setting, which goes back to your question of the immune setting in smoldering myeloma versus relapse, and how immune cell sequencing that you've shown in your studies and we've shown indicates that indeed the T cells are less exhausted and much more beneficial to be used for immunotherapy in a smoldering setting, potentially compared to a relapse setting. So maybe the best drugs of immunotherapy should be used earlier rather than later. So
exactly.
Giving us some of your...
Exactly. So it brings us around full circle to understanding the importance of the immune response and the host immunity in controlling and determining the equilibrium in smoldering myeloma. And where this equilibrium is lost is when patients progress to myeloma. And what we've done, we've looked at the T cells in smoldering myeloma, and indeed they show a skewed differentiation. So they're obviously responding to antigen, and and they show evidence of chronic antigen exposure, and they're skewed in differentiation, but they're still functional. They're not exhausted, so this may be the ideal setting in which to use immunomodulatory agents, immunotherapy, and your bispecific antibodies. But so I think one of the most exciting concepts is the idea of fixed duration, being able to eradicate the clone and getting deep, sustainable, durable MRD negativity, and being able to give these patients years and years of treatment-free and ideally a disease-free survival.
Yeah, so you bring up a very good point of toxicity, but also will that cause harm? Will the clones become resistant later on? And with a fixed duration of therapy and potentially leaving them without therapy for a very long time, whether that will actually lead to, if they progress, and hopefully they don't for many, many years, and they are with an amazing quality of life, but even if they progress, they have been off therapy and there is no evidence of clonal selection with long-term follow-up, although we need still long-term follow-up of our patients. But maybe an answer is potentially immunotherapy in an earlier setting. There were lots of, you know, discussions today about early detection, risk stratification, early interceptions. Just want to have a sense from you, what are the take-home messages?
Yeah, I think there's clearly a lot of interest in this space. As you can see, there's a lot of enthusiasm, and I think just learning across all the different disciplines, I think, has been great. There's so many similarities between all these precursor hematologic conditions that, you know, you can learn from each other and really take it back and kind of develop the next processes to kind of further fine-tune this. But I think the big take-home message, again, is identifying the patient population that is going to, you know, benefit the most from these therapies, and then really figure out what that best therapy is and the right duration and timing.
And Kui?
Absolutely, no, I agree. But I think identifying the right patient population is still a challenge in many areas, and perhaps globally as well. Really, if you have a screening strategy, getting that to the right population and the right group of people. And the other big take-home message for me is the priority on the part of the patients. It's what patients want and what patient priorities are. And we need to try and understand that in order to develop the best way forward and to manage them best, and also to get them to enter studies and take part in our screening trials and our interventional studies.
Absolutely. The patient voice is the most important voice, not ours, but them.
Yes.
So with that, we want to say thank you, everyone. Thank you both for an amazing meeting in the intersection of blood cancer. We look forward to next year and look forward to many other discussions on early detection and interception in across blood cancers. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VJHemonk and subscribe to VJHemonk podcasts on Spotify, Apple, and Podbean. Until next time.